This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There was a recent story about the spread of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in Africa. And in particular, because of the way some healthcare systems work there, you can basically, if you're sick, go to a street stall and buy any antibiotics you want. And so in some cases, they've been so overused that the bacteria develop a resistance to them. Dr. Guy Palmer is Regents Professor of Pathology and Infectious Diseases at Washington State University. And you've studied the treatment of infectious diseases and how bacteria evolve. Is what is happening in Africa going to end up affecting the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's a great question, really at the heart of this issue. And because individuals can travel from any part of the globe within 24 hours to any other part, what happens in one part of the world actually directly affects all of us. So a traveler in India returning to the U.S., they can be in Seattle within a matter of 18 hours. And let's just say they've picked up a small infection, a diarrheal infection as an example. So they immediately then go into a healthcare facility to receive care within Seattle. So what has happened in India within 18 hours is now in a healthcare setting in Seattle.
Are we prepared to deal with that kind of thing? Because as far as I know, we don't examine people who are arriving here from other countries unless there's some indication that country has had a massive outbreak of something.
Yeah, that's a great question and a very key part of this problem. If we look at the infection control procedures, so at Harborview, if we look at Dr. John Lynch, who is in charge of their infection control procedures, he's very attuned to this issue, very aware of it. And they are wary of travelers returning home from other countries, especially if they've been in a healthcare facility in another country. If you go in for a surgery or a minor procedure, they'll often ask you, have you been in a foreign country receiving clinical care within the last 30 days? Mm-hmm. That's exactly the question they're getting at, the risk that you could be carrying and therefore bring into their healthcare facility, let's say Seattle's healthcare facility, an organism from a distant site. Harborview does it, just to an exceptional degree. But you can imagine smaller clinics and smaller hospitals, rural hospitals, would have a great deal of trouble.
The other thing that I'm hearing along these lines is that climate change is going to increase the number of infections because of the effect on the insect population. What's your take on this?
Climate change is going to have a large number of effects. When there's crop failures and drought, that drives people into cities. And when these people come into cities, they tend to go, obviously, to the most impoverished areas. So you increase the density of these urban slums, where today over a billion people live worldwide. You're not improving the sanitation, and therefore you're increasing the need for continual antibiotic consumption.
Right. And you see, I was reading the description of one of these casual cities, and there's no sewer facilities. And it sounds like an absolute microbial stew brewing. Are you saying essentially that the rest of us had better do something about this while we can, or else? Because it doesn't sound like it's going to fix itself.
That's definitely correct. It is not going to fix itself. And we need to pay attention to these informal settlements, these urban slums. And we can do it from a sense of social justice, or we can do it from a purely self-protective desire to reduce the spread of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Bill Gates and some of his billionaire pals are trying to do what they can in Africa. The programs that are now underway, are they enough to make a difference? And if not, what would it take?
Individuals like Bill Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have been tremendously catalytic, as has Paul Allen, as many of people in the Seattle and Washington State community. And catalytic is really the right word. They bring light to these problems. They're not going to solve them alone, but galvanizing the support within the countries is critical. And also just looking at this with a broader lens, every individual, every child has a right to clean water and sanitary facilities. But aside from what we would call that basic human right, there is also this need to measure what level of sanitation can we achieve? We're not going to make one of these slums look like Mercer Island overnight, but what is the minimal level of sanitation we need to achieve in order to reduce this constant rate of infection that's driving the antibiotic use?
So it sounds like you feel if we take that approach to do what will help rather than what looks the prettiest, that this is something that can be effectively dealt with?
Yes, it certainly can be mitigated. We're not going to stop the evolution or spread of antibiotic resistance, but we certainly can reduce it. And, you know, a headline that says we're all doomed is not helpful at all, because this is a problem. It is a public health problem. It's a global health problem. But it is one that can be mitigated through dealing with these conditions in a slum, to getting better advice to our physicians and healthcare providers so that they have more precise ways to assess which incoming patients would be at most risk for carrying one of these infectious diseases. So it's really a multi-pronged approach. And when we look at it from that viewpoint, I think it is something we certainly can mitigate. Here in the Northwest, we're working together with Seattle Children's Hospital, University of Washington, Harborview, Providence Healthcare Systems to try to address exactly this holistic approach.
And given that infectious diseases are your passion, I'm curious on how you think we're handling this current measles outbreak here in Washington and other cities around the country where it's occurred.
It's the long-term consequence of relaxing your guard when, in fact, you don't see these infectious diseases for long periods of time. We tend to forget the importance, the critical importance of vaccination. And the diseases like measles are not trivial. I'm of the age that certainly I had measles as a child, and for many people, it's a temporary kind of infectious disease that children recover from. But it can also be very serious. It was not long ago that measles was one of the top 10 killers of children in the world. So I think maintaining that vigilance is a real challenge, to make sure that people understand the importance of vaccination, not only for their own children, but how it protects all children. These vaccines are safe. They're not related to these developmental disorders such as autism, and they're effective. They're effective not only for your children, they're effective for all children.
Dr. Guy Palmer is Regents Professor of Pathology and Infectious Diseases at WSU. Guy, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The big story this morning seems to be Julian Assange. Is he a journalist just doing his job or an accomplice to an illegal computer hack? Assange first became famous for disclosing secret files on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Justice Department wants him extradited from Britain to face criminal charges here. So we talked with CBS News Justice Department correspondent Paula Reed, who says this has been in the works for some time.
Under seal, U.S. federal prosecutors early last year filed a single charge of computer intrusion against Julian Assange. And in these charges, which as a recovering lawyer, I can tell you, they're a little thin, but what they allege is that Assange helped former military analyst Chelsea Manning hack into certain Pentagon systems, that he helped him crack this password that he needed to go into these systems, steal documents, which he then passed along to Assange to publish on WikiLeaks. The document also alleges that Assange then solicited more information from Manning. So this is crafted to basically blunt any argument that Assange was just doing what a journalist would do, receive information from a source and publish it. It's clear federal prosecutors, they saw that argument coming a mile away. And so they charged him, basically helping to crack a password and break into Pentagon computers, which, of course, is not covered by the First Amendment.
I see. Okay, because I've been trying to figure, I'm old enough to remember the Pentagon Papers case, and you're saying this is not that.
That's how prosecutors want to set this up. The problem is the evidence is a little thin. They're relying on a lot of encrypted conversations between Assange and Manning. It is expected that there will be additional charges. But the reason they only put this one out right now is because they don't want him to drag out extradition for a few years on this First Amendment argument. That's something that they can make once they're here. But when you look at this, I mean, again, he is communicating with him, trying to help him hack into a database. Yeah. That is a little bit different under the law, because technically hacking and stealing passwords is a crime.
Okay. The other big story on your beat is, of course, we're awaiting the release of the full Mueller report. I guess the latest speculation is it's going to be next week. But when the Attorney General appeared before Congress, he also dropped this bombshell that there might have been spying on the Trump campaign and implied that there ought to be an investigation of the investigators. First time we've heard that from an Attorney General. So do you think that's actually going to happen?
Well, I know I can confirm in talking with sources close to this investigation that Barr has assembled a team to look into the origins of the Russia investigation and make sure everything was on the up and up. Now, he believes, as do other people within the Justice Department, that it may be too easy to open counterintelligence investigations. I'll give you an example. Attorney General Jeff Sessions had a counterintelligence investigation opened against him when he was Attorney General after he failed to disclose his contacts to the Russian ambassador. There is some feeling that the bar is too low and it needs to be raised, which is why they're looking into the Russia investigation's origins, which by my reporting was legitimately based and, of course, bore a lot of fruit. But then the Attorney General Barr, remember, this is his second round, of course, of being Attorney General. This is his second rodeo. He knows what he's doing. He's a very smart man. He suggested under oath that he believed there may have been spying on the Trump campaign. I mean, something the president had said just moments earlier, maybe about an hour earlier. And it appeared in many ways to put those two statements, the president's calls for an investigation, Barr's claims of spying, together. I mean, a lot of people were questioning, wait a second, is this Attorney General carrying water for the president? Now, eventually, Barr walked that back. Yeah. He said that's not what he meant. He said there's a possibility, and he's looking into it. But it was a massive misspeak, if that's what it was. So there are a lot of questions. Did you misspeak, or were you speaking to an audience of one?
And one more thing, Paula. The attempt to get a look at the president's taxes. The readouts I've heard on this 1924 law make it sound really clear that the taxes have to be turned over, not necessarily disclosed, but turned over to the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Do you see any way that can legally be blocked?
I don't, and I think you make the perfect distinction. The law doesn't say they have to be released, just turned over to the chairman of the committee. There may be one or two other people whose eyes may lay on them, but they're not going to be released publicly. And again, this statute, it talks about how the IRS has to audit the president and vice president every year. And look, Chairman Neal, he got creative. He said, look, this is maybe our in to get the tax returns. We're going to say we're thinking of some legislation to make sure this actually works, so we need to look at the tax returns. Just on the face of it, legally, it does appear to be a sound argument. But this is going to wind up in court. Ultimately, it'll be up to a federal judge, possibly a panel of federal judges on the Supreme Court, to decide whether or not he'll be able to get these tax returns.
CBS Justice Department correspondent Paula Reed. And Cairo film critic Tom Tangney is here with this week's Friday Film Review. Before we do that, Tom, this time last week you were talking about Shazam.
Yes,
I was. A film of which you were not a big fan. But you did tell us, and it was a remarkable bit of candor, that kids would like it a whole lot more.
That's right.
And so I said, well, we should really get a kid to review this film. That would only be fair. And so we've done that, apparently. Here is 13-year-old Gavin Honeycutt, who goes to Renaissance Middle School in Sammamish. He was listening to our show in the car, and he was with his dad. And he said, okay, I can do that. So here is Gavin's two-minute, age-appropriate review of Shazam.
When I was watching the movie, I thought something that was really cool was how relatable the movie was. Like, when Billy Batson got his superpowers, he did what literally every kid would do. He used his powers for fun. Instead of doing the hero thing, like, he messed around. He, like, went through malls charging people's phones and raiding vending machines.
Right.
Okay. And, like, dropped the school's bully's car in front of the school.
So is every kid sort of like wish fulfillment, their dreams come true? If you had all the superpowers in the world, you'd use them for fun and to get back at bullies.
Yeah. I thought all the jokes were funny. Like, there were a few jokes that were probably for kids even younger than me, but I thought all the jokes landed pretty well, and it was a really funny movie, and it didn't get exhausting to watch.
There, anything you didn't much like about the movie, or was it, you know, ace in the hole for you?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of a picky part, but in the final fight scene between the seven sins, they have the power to disappear, but then 2 minutes later during the battle, they just stop using that power. So it just didn't really make sense to me. But overall, it was a pretty good movie, and they didn't really have any other mess-ups.
Okay. And then since you're almost a 14-year-old like Billy was, did you identify with Billy in any way before he became Shazam?
Well, I thought the group of friends that he had, like, I felt like those were kind of friends, like his family that he had, like, even though it was his family. I thought all those friends, like, I was looking back, and if you, like, made them younger, I thought those would be my friends because I could, like, relate all those friends. And then Billy, like, the friends he chose to have matched up with the friends I had. So I thought that was pretty relatable.
Very good. Okay, and now the most important question, and this is strictly for Dave Ross. Out of four, how many tangs would you give Shazam?
I think I'd give it a 3.5.
So 3.5 tangs out of four.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gavin Honeycutt.
Hey, that's the first guest tanger that we've ever had on the show.
So he thought the jokes landed. Yeah, that's you. Right.
Oh, in fact, he told me, because we didn't have time to run everything, he told me, he says, yeah, Tom, you said like one out of every 20 jokes landed. I there were people in the audience, there were lots of adults, and they were laughing too, you know. It was right. Great. Well, touche, Gavin.
It's about time you got some pushback.
Yeah, that's right.
You imperialist, you. Okay, this week's review. This is a movie called High Life.
High Life.
I will say, if there are any astronauts who disagree with your review, invite them to get in touch with Tulsa.
That's exactly right. And this is definitely not age appropriate for 13-year-olds. So, Gavin, if you're listening, you might not want to listen. This is a very dark movie. So, yeah, the movie is called High Life, and it's a work of art. It's a work of art that you really have to work at to appreciate, since it makes very few concessions to its audience regarding storyline or characters. In fact, you spend most of its 110 minutes just trying to make sense of what's going on. Now, in the end, there are still gaps in your understanding, but you do realize the movie does have a commercially viable premise, and its characters had the potential to be real box office draws. It's just that the film is simply not interested in cashing in that way. It would rather provoke discussion than offer up clever plot twists, romantic tensions, and character arcs to satisfy expectations. High Life is an art film with a capital A. That should not come as any surprise to anyone familiar with the work of the auteur, Claire Denis. She spent decades making esoteric films in French, and she's staying true to form with High Life, even though it's in English, stars a British movie star, and is set in outer space. All personal firsts for her. It's the latter aspect, I suspect, that surprises most Denis fans. But she is quick to say that, despite the setting, it's really more like a prison movie than a sci-fi flick. That's an apt remark, given that the spaceship the movie is set on is filled with convicts. We eventually figure out that the dozen or so people on board were all either on death row or facing life sentences down on Earth. They were given the chance to go on a mission to the far reaches of outer space instead of serving out their sentence.
We were scum. Trash. Refuse that didn't fit into the system. Until someone had the bright idea of recycling us. To serve science.
To serve science. That sullen voice belongs to, actually, a very good actor named Robert Pattinson, the heartthrob of the Twilight films. He's one of the last surviving criminal astronauts, and through a series of flashbacks, we learn about their double mission. One, to find an alternative energy source via a black hole they're headed toward, and second, to experiment with artificial insemination in space. Oscar winner Juliette Binoche plays the insemination doctor, who clashes with Pattinson's character because he refuses to provide samples for her tests.
I just don't understand how you can still believe in your Class 2 mission. It's like you become a shaman of sperm. It's just a new religion for you.
Because I'm totally devoted to reproduction. Happy monk.
You monk. Things, for the most part, go from bad to worse. It becomes clear that it's more of a suicide mission than anything else. But at one point, a baby is born. Is that the silver lining in an otherwise grim existence? Is Claire Denis somehow getting at the essence of our humanity? Or is life in the face of death a fool's errand, given the prospects? Mull those questions over as you leave the theater, why don't you? The ironically titled High Life might be better called Bleak in Space, or Despair in Space, or Grim Eroticism in Space. No, I've got it. Bleak, Erotic Despair in Space. That should sell some tickets.
So, how many tangs, Tom?
I give it 3 tangs. This is a movie you cannot stop thinking about and talking about, but it is a grim sit at the same time.
On the other hand, I saw Marie dancing still at the Fifth Avenue yesterday afternoon. It was fantastic.
It was. Oh, that's
absolutely loved it.
Wow, that's I didn't get a chance to see it, so I'm glad to hear. No, it's good because it's like it's its first version, right? I mean, they're working on this as a work in progress. So that's great to hear.
It was really an amazing show.
Very cool.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Off to Florida, where 20-year-old Big Sister is going above and beyond for her 5 younger siblings. They unfortunately lost both parents to cancer, and she stepped up. She's raising all 5 of them at 20 years old. They've been embraced by their local community, of course. The sheriff's department threw them a Christmas party last year, and the good news spread. An anonymous donor started coming forward. They wanted to do more for this young family. The same sheriff's department organized the surprise made possible by those anonymous donors. They bought her a new car.
There were a number of donors who responded back on our Facebook page about how they could help you and your family.
What? No way.
Congratulations.
They unveiled a picture of this new car. They tell Yahoo Lifestyle that the car has been a blessing to the family. She says it's freed her up to look into college courses. She says most of all, it gives her the opportunity to spend quality time with her siblings. And according to the sheriff's office, the requests to help Samantha and her family just keep coming in from all over the country.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. This happened yesterday in Kansas City.
Swung on and driven deep to right center field. This baby's a laser shot, and it's gone! Daniel Vogelbeck has given the Mariners a 7-6, 10th inning lead here in Kansas City. Vogie with another bomb!
The man whose autographed baseball I own, Vogie, is that what we're calling him now?
I like Vogelwagon.
Vogelwagon.
Built for power.
That's right, what sound did that make?
Yeah, I believe it is now just a monster truck revving.
Ah.
Don't get him started.
It's certainly not a little.
On mynorthwest.com, you wrote the line, "What if the Mariners really are this good?" Do you mean that?
Yeah, I do. I spent the past 24 hours, because that was, of all the Mariners' 13 victories, that might have been the most improbable. They had one hit for the first 5 innings. They were down 4-0. They trailed 6-3 going into the 8th inning. They trailed 6-4 and were down to their final strike in the 9th inning when Mitch Haniger hit a 2-run triple to tie it, send it to extra innings. I went and looked how many teams have been 13-2. It's not that frequent of an occurrence. Going back to 1969, which is when baseball divided into divisions, you went from having just 2 leagues to having 2 leagues with 2 divisions, and then there would be a playoff before the World Series. Prior to that, the best team from the American League played the best team from the National League. 1969, 50 years. The Mariners are the 9th team. They're the 9th team to start 13-2.
And what happens to those teams that do start so well?
Almost always, they end up in the playoffs.
Really? You just said it. Are you kidding me?
No, there's only been, of those teams.
Don't you dare excite me now.
Of those two, of those 9 teams, the Mariners are the 9th, only 2 failed to make the playoffs. One was in a strike-shortened year when there were no playoffs, and the other one was the 1987 Milwaukee Brewers, who started out 13-0, were 14-1, and they finished outside the playoffs, but they had 91 wins, which, in today's template, today you would certainly make the playoffs.
And I notice you switch from the Trident hat to now the classical S Mariners hat. Is that a superstition? Are you?
The other one was stanky.
Okay, all right. I just want to make sure. I want to set the other everyone one
got,
up for success
The other
here.
One got thoroughly stanky. I do like the Trident
I've
hat.
Got the
I don't.
Trident
I don't believe in the superstitions.
Chris,
about that.
Okay, I'm Captain Bring Down.
Stop, no.
The Astros
Why?
Are coming to town. Is this going to be the real proof of, okay, are we for? Because they're. I mean, we know that they set the standard.
Boo.
And I'm just curious, if they do well this weekend, is that time for everybody to jump on board?
You can ignore him.
No, it's time for everybody to jump on board right now. They're 13-2. And if they
I don't
come
like in, having my heart broken every year. I wanted to see them beat really good teams and then know I'm in.
Well, that's a great attitude about life, Chris. That
it
means
sure
you'll
is.
Never fully like embrace or get excited by winning teams in the future. Of like,
yeah.
Oh, this one time they hurt my feelings, so now I don't want to do it anymore. Yeah. Come on, get back on
so
the horse.
Really, I mean, if they, what do you expect? I mean, they're playing the Astros.
Now is not the time for caution. They're 13-2.
I expect it to be a good series. They've got Wade Miley. I believe Wade Miley's on the mound tonight. He pitched for the Mariners and he stunk. So I'm hoping that the Mariners can take a bat. He owes us a stinker. for how bad he pitched for Seattle. He should go out there and absolutely give it up tonight. No, honestly, it would be a disappointment if they didn't win one game in the series. If they win two of the three, you feel really, really strong about it. And that's what I would say. But if they get swept, I'm not going to say, well, see, this was just fool's gold. 13-2, that's enough of a sample size to say at this point I'd be surprised if they ended up with a losing record, which a week ago I would not have felt and said that.
42 run differential.
Yeah.
The biggest in the league.
Very, very solid.
Yeah. All right, let's talk briefly about the Masters. Chris has some grievances to air, Chris.
I don't have, it's not really grievances because I love watching Augusta, but I thought this would play into kind of Danny's hand because I got a little hate in me today.
Yeah.
Bryson DeChambeau, I'm not sure if he's leading or was leading after the, you know, tied for the lead out. If there's a worse golfer out there for the fans, don't seem to like this guy because he cares about dew point and agronomy and wind speed, and he spends like 10 minutes on each shot because of all the science involved. Does that bother you, Danny?
I'm not a big fan of it. I believe you should hit the ball. When I learned to golf, I learned at the hand of my stepfather, who labored over every single shot. It was joyless. He took every bit of enjoyment out of golf by just standing over it and thinking and thinking and thinking. Now, Bryson DeChambeau actually then has the courtesy to hit a good shot where my stepfather stunk, was god-awful horrible, among many other faults the man had.
You know, this music makes even you sound like the Hallmark Channel.
Really? Yeah. As I'm spitting about my undying hatred toward my stepfather?
Yeah. No, that's great.
And how about, quickly, Danny, flags in while putting.
Yeah.
That just bugs the heck out.
Yeah, you know what? Come on, pull the flags. Pull the flags. This isn't T-ball. Pull the flags. Yeah. You don't get to roll it there as hard as you want.
Bring the energy back up. The Sounders are undefeated.
Oh yeah! Awesome.
Woo! You could have Danny and me going.
Yeah,
woo!
There we go. Well, hey. What are they? Have they won all their games, or have there been some ties in there? Have there been some nil-nil barn burners?
It's more exciting than this.
I believe you might be right about
they
that.
They all walked off together, hand in hand, into the sunset, happy once again
over McKillicuddy's Creek.
Yeah. No.
The Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington.
Yeah, threw that, left a floater in Rays Creek on that one as I walked over Hogan's Bridge off to the old decrepit scary cabin.
The Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. I don't know what about McGillicuddy, anything about McGillicuddy.
Could you imagine this, a horror flick set in the bunker cabin?
Absolutely.
A huge step forward for the effort to clear the state's massive backlog of unexamined rape kits, and state lawmakers are now considering a bill that would get more DNA into the criminal database. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
It was the most aggressive effort yet to address the backlog of 10,000 untested rape kits in our state. And yesterday, after getting unanimous approval in the Senate, it finally crossed the finish line. It was an emotional moment for rape survivor Leah Griffin, who fought for years to clear the backlog.
I am thrilled. This has been years in the making, and everybody came together to really push to make this happen and shown survivors that our stories matter and that our trauma is valid and that our cases should be investigated in a thorough and timely manner. And then to see it pass through the Senate unanimously was absolutely incredible.
The bill requires all old kits be sent for testing and that the testing be completed within 2 years. It also creates a new high-tech lab to dramatically cut the testing time and includes important rights for sexual assault survivors.
It makes sure that survivors can get access to a police report for free, which is a huge deal in being able to get a sexual assault protection order. It guarantees a right to a legal advocate, somebody to guide you through the very confusing process. Not only that, but it cuts this testing time from 14 months to 6 weeks. Right now, there are survivors in our state waiting over a year for basic evidence to be tested in their case, and that's too long.
And as important as getting those kits tested and investigations started for sexual assault survivors, it is equally important to test the kits to find those attackers, often repeat offenders, and get them off the street for public safety. To help with that effort, lawmakers are also considering a separate bill to expand DNA in the criminal database that can be used to match in all crimes, from rape to murder. The bill would require those convicted of indecent exposure to submit DNA samples and have them put in the national database. It also requires samples for sex offenses where the suspect gets a deferred sentence or time served, and also allows DNA samples from offenders who have died to be taken and uploaded into CODIS. Lindsay Wade is a former Tacoma police officer who is now an investigator with the state attorney general's office and says expanding the DNA database is crucial for public safety.
I know firsthand the power of DNA in solving violent crimes like sexual assaults and homicides, and I believe that this bill will enhance law enforcement's ability to solve more violent crimes in our state by ensuring that DNA is collected properly and entered into our national DNA database known as CODIS.
This bill is named for 12-year-old Michelle Welch and 13-year-old Jennifer Bastian, two Pierce County girls killed in the 80s whose cases went cold until last year when DNA helped lead to their suspected killers. Jennifer Bastian's mom, Patty, told lawmakers this week just how important the bill is.
Two 32-year-old cold cases were solved with this technology, among others, and tremendous detective work. I can't speak enough for the parents who are waiting for answers, for victims who are waiting for answers, as well as the possible deterrent that this bill by itself may cause. If you know you're going to get caught if you do a crime, particularly a sexual one, against another person, perhaps you'll think twice about doing it.
So, Hannah, this is a total win, it sounds like, and it had bipartisan support?
Yeah, absolutely. The rape kit bill legislation had unanimous approval in both the House and the Senate and was a really tremendous bipartisan effort all throughout the session. Even before the session, Representative Tina Orwell especially did some tremendous work on this. But yeah, it's a good deal. The only thing is the rape kit, the new lab that's in there and the new staff that they're going to hire has a $12 million or so budget ask, but both the House version and the Senate version of the budgets currently include that, so it looks pretty promising.
Very good. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah. Rachel Bell decided to visit a hospital.
Little Cassie Turner was born on February 5th at just 28 weeks. She came 3 months early. Cassie's in the UW Medical Center's neonatal intensive care unit, growing and getting stronger by the day. Her dad, Shannon Turner, drives up from Paulsbo every weekend, and her mom, Danielle, has been with her every moment since she's been born.
So I sit on a couch, but it pulls out into like a small little bed. We have a freezer and a refrigerator here, so I keep food here and can do laundry and a shower.
Being away from home and her other children has been tough, not to mention being cooped up in a little hospital room. But Danielle has found some relief from Gail Cloud, the NICU's dedicated neurological music therapist. Gail works with parents to create custom lullabies to sing to their babies.
We named this Cassie's Lullaby. I actually work with parents to help them select the right words, the right sentiment, or the terms of endearment that have special meaning for them. In Shannon and Danielle's case, they picked the names of their children because it became a family affair, that the whole family was going to be engaged in singing to little Cassie.
Leah loves you so much. Ethan loves you so much.
I knew that we wanted to do something faith-based, so as we chose Jesus Loves Me, because it's an easy melody to follow and to craft music around that. So Gail is so brilliant. So she came in, and I was like, hey, I'm not good about making rhymes, but this is what I want to tell our daughters that she can hold on to and grow and listen to. And so she was able to pull these beautiful verses and rhymes together that just... It was beautiful when she sang it. I was like, oh my gosh, yes, I love it.
Cassie, girl, we love you so. You get stronger as you grow.
Creating and singing a lullaby has all kinds of benefits.
I can honestly say that Gail helped bring my wife back to herself, because being locked up in a room 24/7, basically, you have really no control over what's going on around you. This program provided an outlet.
Lullabies also help babies heal faster.
Science has actually shown that because lullabies are both metrically and melodically and rhythmically very, very simple, they also have a lot of repetitive elements to them that can be very calming and very physiologically and emotionally beneficial for babies. Music can help reduce stress responses, so it can help lower blood pressure. In the NICU, it can also help increase oxygen saturation levels or help with sucking and feeding patterns.
But when Danielle and Shannon sat side by side, cuddling Cassie in the NICU, softly singing her own lullaby, it was less about science and all about love.
It was a way for me to establish that connection. It took me away from everything else that was outside. It helped me focus. It got me relaxed. This was something that was really meaningful because this was something that my mom did for me. And so to have this opportunity to carry it on and to give it to Cassie, it's more meaningful because of touching her and singing to her and having her feel the vibrations from me to her. You know, the small smile or even getting a Popeye, one eye open, as I like to say, was great because she knew me, she felt me, and she knew that I was here for her.
Danielle and Shannon are hopeful that they'll be able to take Cassie home by the end of the month, which is when she would have reached full term.
We all love you so.
And you made me cry.
Lullabies in the neonatal intensive care unit. So they got you crying, huh?
Yes, it did make me messed up. It was very sweet.
Just listening to the sounds the little girl was making reminds me of course, my own granddaughter's sounds shortly after she was born and how much attention we pay to her. And she's completely healthy.
Gail, the woman who does the music work with patients, she also works hospital-wide. And here's something she told me that I didn't know about how the brain processes music.
So the part of the brain that we use for music is actually different than the part of the brain that we use for speech. So we can use music and singing as a way to open up new neural pathways so that people can actually find their way to being able to speak again in some instances.
Music is so fascinating. You know, people just automatically, naturally just sing to their children. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you can sing or not, it doesn't matter if you have a bad voice or a good voice, your child doesn't care. And it just is something that Gail said. I asked her, you know, is this something we've been doing since we lived in caves? And she said, probably. There's just something that parents instinctively know is therapeutic for calming their child.
Kyle Radio's Rachel Bell.